I'm Connie Jacobs, and I am the storyteller for this week. And today's stories are called personal stories, yours and mine. This is probably the hardest section of all the sections that I have chosen, simply because personal stories are stories that are either handed down in your generation or in past generations in your family. They are a record keeping of your family. And we can all hear, well, my grandfather was born in such and such in Norway, and he came over here. We can tell those personal stories. They don't affect us. But when all of a sudden you go into my great aunt was raped, or my great aunt was taken to Norway, and there she had an abortion and came back in 1908, then you're getting into the personal side. And you're starting to feel, and you may have relatives that may say, she shouldn't be telling those stories. They shouldn't be told. Or when you come to your own, which I'm going to be telling today, and they are all your own stories, sometimes they hurt so much you wonder, can I get through this without weeping? I do have some stories that I know would be wonderful personal stories that I haven't yet gotten down on paper. So I know I can't be telling them, because even to put them on paper, I start feeling at such a large degree, I don't know which words to use or how to put it. And then to stand up, the leap of faith in yourself and in your audience is tremendous. To feel that what you have to say is worth hearing, that your audience is going to react to what you have to say, is of a valid reaction to you, and you're afraid to expose yourself. And this comes in on your personal stories. And I think it's harder for men than for women when it comes to personal stories, because even in talking, women are better at explaining detail and telling something. Where my husband may say, oh, George committed suicide down there on the South 40 on that farm. That's what he's told somebody downtown. True, George did commit suicide down on the South 40. Where I may say, God, George had bad luck. All of his cattle got this disease and he couldn't sell them and they had to be killed. And then the floods came and took all of the crops and he was mortgaged to the hilt. He didn't know what else to do. He shot himself. Here you get a feeling of why George committed suicide. Here you know that it's a fact. Your personal stories are the difference between your absolute bare-bone fact and the feelings behind them. And the music I was playing is called Tracks We Leave. And I'm going to end today's program with a poem, short poem called Tracks We Leave. And I'm going to begin my day with a poem that my sister wrote called Home Place. Since we share the same home place, I figure I can use that to begin with. This is my sister. This book is for sale over in the bookstore. Put a plug in for that one. This is called Home Place, and this is from South Dakota. And our grandfather started this place. The shore of a sandy lake abuts the edge of my memory close like the much-loved land. Some of us, mostly daughters, move away. But the feel of earth between our toes, sun hot above grain spun to gold, chaff, an itch beneath our shirt's sweat, and the brief cool reprieve of a reluctant rain washing through the cracks of western window frames on the old home place remains vivid. As if being young there had just happened, and our mother, seated in the shade of an elm shelling peas, lifts her head at our father's call from his pickup truck window to come check cattle at the Dacre place. The shore of Sandy Lake weaves along the reed's slim edge of my memory like the haunting land. Each autumn I hear calves bawling and the calling geese, blues and snows fall from grace in that season. Years gather like fleet clouds on the horizon. This is the home place. We grew up on a refuge where there was a lot of animals. We had a lot of hunters. The man that started all of this was our grandfather, who stood about 5'6" and red-haired. He was Norwegian. Big voice, big laugh, and loved to drink, and was good at making money. And then he married this rather large woman who bore five rather large sons and three daughters. But this woman, because of her largeness, the sons were also large, and Grandpa Lars could go into Houghton, into the local pool hall, bring his sons with him. He could go in there, pick any fight, and yell, and they'd come in and clean up. And this was the grandfather that died 2 months before I was born. He did know my sister. He never knew me. But I was at a storytelling convention, and a man stood up and told a joke that tied in with his story, and all of a sudden, boom, it rang a bell with just a little tiny story on my grandfather. But he said that there was this big hunting man that had gone all over the world, gone all over, hunted big game. And he'd gone to this one area in the Holy Land just to visit, and someone said they had the best hunting dogs in the entire world. I mean, they had hunting dogs that could walk on the water. And this man thought, my word, I've got to have one of those. And then he found out that the hunting dog cost like $50,000. Well, he calls home to his banker and said, I'm getting this hunting dog. I'm bringing it home. It can walk on water. And the banker says, can't. So he buys this dog and brings it home. And then he brings out a family friend, and that family friend and he go out on the boat and do all this duck hunting all day long. All day long, this magnificent dog runs out there right across the water, picks up that duck, brings it right back, puts it right into the boat, and sets down. And the man says nothing. This man thinks, some friend I've got doesn't even notice my magnificent dog. So finally that night, they were all done hunting, and they went into the cabin, and they were taking care of the duck, and he says, you know, Henry, you didn't even say anything about my wonderful hunting dog. He says, didn't you notice anything unusual about my dog? He says, well, come to think of it, I did. You know, I don't think I've ever seen a dog that couldn't swim. But give me time to laugh, because it is. I just sat there and laughed, and immediately I go, click. Because the story I remember hearing was of my old fiery, short-haired, red-haired grandfather, and my, at that time, big, I wasn't anywhere around, or even a gleam in an eye, big father, riding in this little Model A or Model T, and it had the top cut off, because it was used also out for trapping. And Dad was driving, because Grandpa didn't really like to drive too often. He didn't know how to use the brake. It was usually, whoa there, Bessie, and pull on the steering wheel, and he'd hit trees and barn doors and such. But they're out driving, and it's a real foggy, foggy day, and about a quarter mile from the place, and they're just driving along, and they hear all these geese. And remember, we live on a refuge. But they hear all these geese above. Can't see them because the clouds are so low and the fog's so heavy. And Dad pulls out the shotgun and shoots a couple times right into the air. And according to them, geese fell all around them. And all Grandpa said was, Lordy, Ralphie! Ralphie, that sure is some good shooting. And no aim, no nothing. But this is how stories trigger stories, trigger stories. But here I've told stories that are easy to tell. Third grade. I cheated today, and I got caught. I got caught by the county superintendent. Not by the teacher, but by Mrs. Johnson, my mom's close friend. I got caught by Mrs. Johnson. It wasn't an accident that I cheated. I planned it. I mean, I know we have spelling tests every Friday, and I got F's every Friday. I mean, I study, and I want an A like my friend Linda Spur. Linda Spur always gets A's. She doesn't study. I study. I go home and I sit down at the table in the kitchen with my mom, and I sit there with my pencil and I sit, and she says, okay, write. And I go, R-I-T-E. Light, L-I-T-E. Fight, F-I-T-E. Oh, honey, can't you remember I-G-H-T is it? But Mom, you said every time you have an E at the end, it makes the vowel long. She says, but there are differences to the rules. I-G-H-T is it. O-T-E will make the O long, and it will be O-T, whatever you stick in front. Mom. So I go to school the next day. Today is Friday. I'm just going to get some insurance. So about half an hour before spelling test comes around, I go out to the bathroom. One girl can be checked out, one boy can be checked out. I check out to the bathroom. The minute I'm out that door, I'm running as fast as I can across the alley to our little country church. And I open the door and go on in, and I go right on up to this altar with beautiful Jesus rising to heaven. And I look around, and I'm sure no one's there. And I go, Jesus, please, Jesus, give me an A. I want an A like Linda gets. And I pray out loud. I want him to hear me. And I say, Amen, Jesus. I'll be good. And I tiptoe back out of the church, run as fast as I can back into the school, sign my name, cross it off, sit back down, and this eighth grade boy looks at me and goes, What took you so long? I stick out my tongue. Teacher calls, spelling, and starts pronouncing the words. I know God's going to help me. I write, boat, B-O-T-E, lettuce, L-E-T-T-U-S. Mm-hmm. That O, that E makes that O long, lettuce, U-S. I keep writing all the words, going on down. Okay, children, exchange papers. I give my paper to Linda. She's my best friend. She gives me hers. Teacher pronounces the words, and we get to correct them. Linda's got an A. Linda hands me back my paper. She has a sad face at the top, with one tear coming down. I've missed 11 out of 20 words. F. Glory, glory, hallelujah, the Lord will always stick it to ya. Once again, Jesus let me down. I cheated today and I got caught, and now I can't eat lunch. It wasn't an accident. I planned this one good. I mean, before we had our spelling test, I went to my desk to practice my words. I sat and I wrote every single word perfectly, all 20 of them, all right down the line. I wrote them. I mean, a penmanship teacher would have been so proud of me. And I got to the end. I took that paper and I crumpled it all up like it was waste paper. Then I opened it back up, just good enough so I could see those 20 well-printed words, and I accidentally dropped it on the ground. Teacher pronounced the words. I sat. I wrote my words. I was looking. My head was pointed right at my desk. My eyes were pointed right at the floor. I knew I had an A. All right, students, hand in your papers. And I proudly got up and brought my paper up to the teacher, turned around and walked, and Mrs. Johnson sitting right behind my desk. She came in when I didn't know it. There she is, the county superintendent, holding my crinkled up paper. She just looks at it with a strange smile and says, Connie, do you think your mother would like to see this? And I look at her, sit at my desk, and now I can't eat lunch. Spelling. I've hated spelling. Even to this day, my written word is entirely different than my spoken word. The minute I'm stuck with having to write something down, I revert to words that a third and fourth grader would easily understand and comprehend. I might even hesitate using the word comprehend if I'm not sure. Spelling has been a boon to me. About 3 years ago, my sister and my mother decided to buy me one of those spelling machines. It's a wonderful idea. I used it at first, Don't use it much anymore. I quickly discovered that those machines are not computed to my spelling. I put in the word, it flashes across the top if it's correct, or it says no such word. Most of the words that I type in say no such word. And this is the way spelling continues to be in my life, although I have gotten better. 5 years ago, I took a graduate course at Northern State Teachers College. I've taken many graduate courses, but this was probably one of the most painful. This was in British literature. The entire course was lecture, essays, and test writing essay. Anything I had to write outside the classroom, fine, I got an A on. Any test that he handed us in the classroom, I had problems with. And I knew I was going to have problems from the first day I walked in. He talked constantly. He was difficult to understand. He was from India, but you quickly would pick on to exactly what he was saying and what he was meaning. Our first test, it was a 3-week course. My test comes back, it's a D minus. I start looking over why. I haven't missed one single question. He's taken 5 points off for every misspelled word. I went up to him afterwards and I said, I have a tremendous difficulty in spelling. I understand and I know the material, but I can't even spell, sometimes especially under pressure, words that a third and fourth grader can spell and I know it. And he looked at me in a very austere way and said, if you can't spell, you shouldn't be in graduate school. No help there. He said, bring a dictionary next time. Second week passed. Second test passed. I got a B minus, a little bit better. Only missed 2 words that time. Looked them all up. The final test came. It was a 3-hour exam. In the middle of the third hour, I noticed that I was one of the few left in the room. The rest had completed and left. And I was very aware that I had to go back over everything that I had written on these 6 pages and check every word that I thought possibly might be misspelled. And this is the process that I was on. And finally, it was down to my instructor and myself. And I came up to him at the end and I said, I can't even remember his name. But I said, I know this is misspelled. I said, I know eunuch is not spelled this way. I said, but I can't find it in the dictionary. And he looked at it and he says, E-U-N, and continued on to spell it. I finished my test. At age 45, went out into the yard of Northern State Teachers College. And this is why I say personal stories are hard. And I sat and sobbed. 45 years old, how do you find a word in the dictionary if you haven't got the right first letter? And maybe this is why I enjoy teaching and I generally have kids that enjoy me as a teacher. Because when they have a tremendous amount of difficulty in an area, I understand. And my 7th and 8th graders from the day that I walk into that classroom know that I'm not a good speller. And what it does in that classroom, because they have spelling every single day, I've become better because of them. But what it does to them is if I can't think of a word or if I all of a sudden say, gloriously beautiful, fantastic day and can't think of how to spell gloriously, I'll say, Gina, how do you spell gloriously? And she'll quickly spell it. This is what I'm writing on the blackboard. What it does to the other student that doesn't spell is make that child say, my teacher can't spell well either. I'll be all right, because she's smart enough. She's a teacher, but she doesn't spell well. So it complements the one and it complements the other. And that has helped. My sister has helped. One time, this was shortly after that course, she probably doesn't even remember saying it to me. I had called her weeping and telling her what had happened. And she says, Connie, look at it this way. you're not a bad speller, you're a creative speller. And it has helped, because it is true. I'm not a bad speller. Anybody can figure out what I'm trying to write if I use the words that I want to use. And this is what a person has got to do as far as their children are concerned, and if you are teachers, as far as your students in your classroom, I think you have to say, okay, here is a weakness, but here is a strength. Let's use the strength, and let's use the weakness, and put them together, and you'll usually get a stronger person in both areas. But we often don't. We end up making the person feel very insignificant because they can't do this area that is so very difficult for them, whether it be speech, whether it be spelling, whether it be math. There are ways that we can make the weakness into a strength. And this is what we've got to learn to do, I think, with our personal stories, is use them. Use them to help enrich the lives of others around you. And this is something, I guess, that I feel is very necessary. I want to trigger a few things with you folks now to kind of make sure that you're nice and relaxed. And close your eyes. Don't go to sleep. Just close your eyes. You're about to go on a trip. Get yourself relaxed and comfortable with your eyes closed. Imagine that you're in a place that you love most. Where is this place? Smell. What smells are in this place? There are memories in this place. Why is it your most favorite place? You leave the place and start out on a trip. Where are you going? Who and what will you see when you get there? What will you take for this trip? You get there and experience the most wonderful experience you have ever had. What was it? What made it so joyful to you? Did the others around you realize what was happening? What did you do afterwards? Now you're being whisked up by the gentle breeze, cool breeze. Where does it take you? What happens when you get there? Does your story end there? Now slowly come back to where you are in this room and open your eyes. Think about your story. Your room, your smells, the trip. Anybody be willing to share? Joe?
Well, it began in my folks' living room around Christmas time, which always has the same types of smells, from candles to Christmas tree to sounds are also very important. Always King's College Choir recordings being played. I always feel very much comforted by that, because it brings back memories of when I was growing up in the home.
And where did you go on your trip?
Well, my trip was to Northfield when my wife was waiting. And it gets very intimate. And then I, when you said the wings take you away, I took that literally.
Yeah.
And I find myself, you know, floating away from Northfield. And for some reason, I just thought of Milwaukee, where I grew up outside of Milwaukee, and I floated to the basketball arena in Milwaukee, where I had some of my best memories as a little child watching the Milwaukee Bucks play. That's where I moved to.
And so it brought in a whole other aspect.
Yeah.
So, anyone else? I had an interesting time with the much-loved room, or the space that you start from when making this trip. Because I started thinking of home, and then suddenly it became a car, a new car. And I love the smell of a new car. And so making the trip, I was in the room that smelled good and that I love and can travel fast and heading west usually. And the rest of it in a way wasn't as poignantly felt, although in my trip I was coming here, coming to Holden. I don't always think of Holden as a much loved place, but it has been important in my life. And then when the wind came, it took me up to the basin up here that we talked about, where I've hiked in the Pacific a couple times in the last 6 weeks. And so it did these kind of interesting movement space things. And the thing that happened when I came to this much loved place was the performance evening, where they did a lift. And it turned out that both Jonathan and Allison were performing. And after that, the four of us walked down the little gravel road out here and sort of up Chalet Hill, and we were just all four walking with arms on each other's shoulders. I'm glad to be in each other's company. Mark, would you share?
Probably my most memorable time was on the river with relatives. They carried the sounds of the river. And the probably the freshness of air. And the, when you were mentioning the wind, I ended up, I could feel that quick breeze as we were on the river and with my relatives and my friends. And, always going back to a home that, with a big family, and it ended up there was all kinds of interaction.
I had a different image in my mind when my eyes were closed, but I'd rather share something else. For me, I'm always looking for the magic moments, and they're usually not the most expected times. But some that come to mind, it might be in a piece of music. Music is a big part of our family, and something might occur in a particular choir that we sing at that will be, it'll just, every nerve ending is attuned, and that to me is a magic moment. And others may feel it too, but it's because something's so incredibly beautiful just for that, that particular second. I can think of other moments. One was when our daughter was about 6 or 7. She had purchased with her own money. It was kind of a knit kind of tie for her brother, who would have been 11 or 12 at the time. And she, I don't know that we ever wore it very much, but when he opened that package, she looked at me and she winked. Like, oh, this is, he's so happy. Myself. It was just one of those connecting kinds of moments. Most of my magic moments I want to connect to someone else. When you talked about walking up the hill with Another time is when all four of us were able to ski the same hill. And we could ride up on the chairlift, and we were all skiing the same hill. Now everyone has left me, and I'm alone, you know, but before it was the littlest child. So those are mine that, you know, just, maybe it's not meaningful to anybody else, but, so music and experiences with loved ones that came into my life.
See, I think music and stories are so important to be handing from generation to generation and adding your own. Because if you're just telling the ones of your great-grandparents or of your parents, it's your own too that have to be handed down. Because your children have to take those and use those to enrich them. And I actually feel that there'd be less divorce if we all would kind of tie more in to our family heritage and say, this was my grandpa, this is the way he felt, this is my mother, this is the way I... But you have an expectation if your family kind of ties together. If you all go off in separate directions, you don't feel the expectation of somebody that loves you. And I think it's important that we have that. Sometimes it's a lot of pressure because you feel mom or dad has too much expectation. But you also feel the love, and I think it kind of bonds your families together. And I think it's very, very valuable. Anyone else?
Early 1960s, I was in the chaplain at Scout Camp between Yosemite and Lake Tahoe for the whole summer, Cascades for itself. And I can still hear the wind coming through the redwoods. And in the distance, I can hear the tune being played on the piano, Misty, which every time I hear the tune, I can remember that particular location, that particular camp. And seeing scorpions running across, about 2 weeks out of the summer, seeing scorpions running across the mountain trail. And then, I'm kind of floating away to another water scene. There's a river that comes, the Stanislaus River comes through the camp, and I just visualize and hear and taste the water. All my senses are, and I reacted in a very feeling way. Then I'm whisked off to Lake Superior with my grandma, who's the official Lake Superior from the Philadelphia. So it kind of bits and pieces. I guess I gathered this story because I took the discipline to write my life story on a computer by starting out in 1937 when I was born. And I made consecutive days 1937 to 1993, and I started gathering information about my life. And every time I gathered bits and pieces, I wrote my computer and fit it into those years. I began to see connections.
And you're also going with feelings, not just facts.
Oh, yeah, well, feelings came out of it because of the connections.
Because this is what I so often find in stories of people. It's facts. I want to know the story. And it might mean, like John Jake's writing. Some people say it's not that good, but for me, to read a history book over here about a civil war and the battles, and so many men were killed, and it happened on this day, and then pick up John Jake's and read how this particular man was ripped apart and they carried him off and his legs were sewed off, and you start following him along with the history. It makes it so much more, I don't know, it brings it home to me a lot more than all of that. That's interesting. I don't know if I have the discipline to start writing things like that.
The stories are drawn out of the connectedness of your past, and you begin to realize I'm a good speaker because I know the stories of my dad being at the University of UP. That's fact. But my understanding of why I enjoy speaking comes out of that. And I think it's a very feeling, intuitive type thing, very emotional.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone else? Going on then, something else that has affected my life, is animals. Mainly dogs. When I was young, I always had hundreds of cats around, and they were my cats. But I guess it's because we had so many that I never got that connected to any one particular cat. And it actually wasn't until my children started leaving me that I started getting really connected to my dogs. But it reminds me of my father. My sister was a freshman at St. Olaf College, and I was, I think, a junior in high school, and my brother was in 7th or 8th grade. Yeah, it might have been a little bit before that. But anyway, Dad decided the kids needed to have a dog. I mean, one kid's gone, the other one's going to be gone in a year, the next one has about 4 years left. But Dad thinks the kids need a dog. He goes to Minnesota because he wants this registered Norwegian elk hound. And he picks up this Norwegian elk hound, and of course, coming from Minnesota, it has to be purebred Norwegian elk hound, Norwegian in the highlights. And he picks out the runt of this entire litter. He has first choice, picks out the runt, because small ones are supposed to be smarter than the big ones. And he brings this dog, then we go to St. Olaf, and we have to show it to my sister and her roommates, and we have pictures of this little short dog that's about this long, about this high, walking across the hood of the car. Then we have other pictures in front of the dorms of this little teeny dog running around. And from day one, that dog was Dad's dog. It went with him all over. And Widget was one of these character dogs that would talk to him. Didn't talk to us. He'd come up and wag, and we'd pet him, and we'd love him and hug him. But Widget loved Dad. And Dad would come out and look at him and say, "Widget, how are you?" And the dog would go, "Well, what are you doing all night? Did you sleep in the barn?" And then sometimes he'd come out and say, "Uh-oh, Widget, you went and found a skunk." Oh. And the dog would put his head down and he'd go over to the door. I mean, I've never seen a dog that would so often get embarrassed and ashamed. But Widget would walk over to the door with his head down and he'd sit there for a long time. Finally, Dad would say, and look around and just prance around and right back to Dad because he's talking to him. We'd come home sometimes late or early from Aberdeen, which was 32 miles from our place. We lived out in the country. And Widget would always come out to the gate to greet us. And he'd just be bounding up and down. And he was so happy, and he was kind of a small Norwegian elk hound. And of course, as we'd drive in this big drive, Widget would have to be running down that road, and he'd have to be looking back at us all the time to make sure we were coming. And this one day, he's running pell-mell. He's going to beat us to the garage door. And we're all watching him, of course, because we think Widget's wonderful. And Widget hits this big elm tree. And it knocks him on his back. And he rolls about 3 or 4 times down the road. And we start laughing and laughing. And Widget stands up and shakes his head, starts running the wrong direction, then comes back. And we're really laughing. And poor Widget looks at us laughing. His head goes down. His tail goes down. And he goes out to the hog shed, and we don't see him for the rest of the night. And it's not because, I'm sure, now I'm putting thoughts and human feelings to my dog here, and it's not because that he hit a tree and got an owie. It was because we all laughed at him. And we weren't laughing with him, we were laughing at him hitting this tree, and he was embarrassed. Well, the years kept going. Karen graduated from college. I went to college, graduated from college. My brother was, I'd say, about a sophomore in college by this time. And Widget's getting up there in years. And we come home one time and we hear this funny story about Widget. Widget no longer can jump into the pickup on his own. So my father, who's also got a heart condition and weighs too much and loves bacon, stoops over all the time. Widget jumps on his back and into the pickup truck he goes. And then they go out and chase the cattle or chase the pigs or whatever they want to chase. Widget gets just as excited inside the cab as he used to get outside when he used to be able to run and keep up with the pickup. So Dad's driving along in the pasture with the pickup, and Widget's watching all these pigs going around and getting all excited and moving as close as he can to Dad because he wants to sit right beside him, and he passes gas. And Dad looks at him, "Widget,
with its head goes down, his tail goes down, he moves clear over the outside of the pickup, and sometimes he even goes down to the floorboards. But pretty soon, of course, Dad's actions and reactions to the cattle out in the field bring Widget back up. Widget gets all excited again, and the whole thing happens over again. But this was Widget. And one of the saddest parts, as far as Widget was concerned, we heard from her mother in later years, Widget got old. We're not sure what killed him or whether it was a disease or how he died. But all of a sudden, Widget wasn't there. And Dad went frantically looking for him throughout the barns that we had. We had two barns and out in the shop. He finally found him a couple days later out behind an old granary that was way out by the refuge water. And there's Widget, dead, and has been dead for a day or two. And Mom says Dad came back to the house and just sobbed and sobbed and sobbed because Widget was no longer with him. And also because Widget didn't come to him when he was hurting and needed and was going to die, but went and found his own quiet little spot. But that was the story of Widget, and it was my father's last dog. And since my children have grown, I've now got a Charlie, and my husband has an Amos. And if anything should happen to them, I'm sure we're going to be just as broken up. And Amos talks to my husband, doesn't talk to me very often, but he talks to him all the time, telling him all sorts of things. If anybody comes into the building, he announces it in a certain bark. Charlie, of course, is my dog, and when I leave, my mother says he sits at the top of the stairs the first few nights and cries and cries and cries because nobody's up there. Charlie's little, Amos is big. They don't like each other, but they get along. And that's dogs that have affected my life. I'm going to end today with the one poem called Tracks We Leave. And this is by William Eaton, as well as the music. The music by William Eaton I love. There are no words to it. But he builds his own instruments and plays them. I'll just hand it around. The ancient ones return as clouds from the rain. Corn will grow. Smells of juniper and sage fill the air. Old Jupiter sparkles on the horizon, and our journey begins. Four corners, four directions. Who has crossed this land? How long do boundaries endure? Above the mesa, the eagle does not see the lines. Birth and death, cultures rising and falling, migrations pass like walking shadows or the chatter of birds, and still the monuments stand among the countless tracks that cross the wind-blown sand. On a mesa at dusk above Monument Valley, our eyes reflect emerging stars, shining feelings and hopes. Our way is unknown, but we will find it and leave tracks.